picture a map of the United States and imagine a number stamped on each state, denoting how many mosques there are in every one. Texas has 67, California 227, and the state of South Dakota, just one. NPR's Jamie Tarabay traveled to Sioux Falls to see this mosque for herself and to meet the people who pray there.
It's a very nondescript building, flat, single-story, facing a football field. Drive past quickly and you miss it among the clapboard houses in the quiet street. It's even smaller on the inside.
This is our female prayer. And you're praying separate. And this is a really small area too for a female prayer.
How many women come to pray?
Approximately maybe 40, 45 on Friday.
Every week in here?
Every Friday, yes.
You can fit 40 women in this room?
Yeah, yeah, because of the...
they have to be pretty small.
Yeah, huh? Really small. You're right. Yeah, we are a really small place. Yeah, we do have a really small place.
Asaf Zabi is the director of Sioux Falls Islamic Center. When he first arrived here from Afghanistan in 1981, there was no mosque. He and the handful of other Muslims used to pray in a different family's living room each Friday.
We bought this building about in 1992. Which was a really bad shape, and we put a new roof and did all the remodeling inside of these buildings. Then since that time, we have a place to pray.
Now, there are around 3,000 Muslims in Sioux Falls, and there's just not enough room for them all to pray. Their young Egyptian imam preaches this Friday about the end of days and warns of false prophets. He says, there is no greater evil or test than the coming of the devil who'll try to convince everyone he is the true Messiah. Around him, men sit packed together on the faded green carpet. Others have no choice but to stand against the wall. Director Zabi says he and other Muslims have traveled to big cities like Chicago and Dearborn to ask larger, more profitable Islamic organizations for donations. But each time, they came back with less than $5,000. And the Sioux Falls Muslims themselves can barely afford to give any money. This is a low-income group of people. Most of the men work at the local slaughterhouse earning minimum wage. That's because this community is mainly made up of refugees from war-torn countries.
My name is Mickey Musa. I'm originally from Sudan. I've been in Sioux Falls since 2001.
Mickey Musa is 41. He sought asylum in the U.S. to escape Sudan's civil war. Someone, somewhere, must have had a sense of humor, sending him from Africa to Sioux Falls in the middle of winter.
What surprised me when I look at the snow coming down, I couldn't imagine this tiny pieces coming down could make all this, accumulation of snow of 6 or 8 inches or in some cases, maybe more.
7 blistering winters later, Musa and his family are still here. He's part of a thriving African community that includes Christian as well as Muslim refugees from places like Ethiopia, Somalia, and Libya. But making friends with his American neighbor, well, that was a bit harder.
First of all, Americans are more independent.
Musa tells a story about a time not long after he got here, when he went next door to say hello to his neighbor.
And then I waited for him to see if he's going to come and talk to me, or if, maybe this relation could be developed, and just to interact, to know each other. For 3 years, he never come and talk to me. It's just the way it is.
There isn't a real divide between the Muslims and the predominantly Protestant residents of Sioux Falls, but there isn't much interaction either. Farewelling friends after lunch on the downtown street are Bob and Tricia Swanhorst. They see the Muslims in their midst quite often.
Well, I see the veil or the hair covering, but I've never had interaction.
No,
so
we really haven't.
But I see them working
in the stores, and yeah. That.
Cashier now and then. Yeah. I think I've seen.
And getting their groceries and things like everybody else.
Bob Swanhorst says he has a lot of sympathy for the new arrivals because his father was an outsider when he first arrived here from Germany in 1923.
I don't know if that's a big factor or not, but it sure opens your eyes to how difficult it is when you're the first person or you're in a foreign country. There's a lot of difference.
That's right. It is.
And culture-wise, that's not a huge transition from Europe to America at that time. It was, but it's not as, as you talk Middle East or Latin America, that's a bigger cultural transition.
The Muslims who live here like the quiet, and most have no plan to go anywhere else. They also like their American neighbors. It's the rest of the Muslim community in America they feel far away from. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Sex, racy text messages, an illicit wedding ceremony, and maybe a messy divorce. It sounds like a TV soap opera, but no, it comes courtesy of the Anglican Communion, and it all figures into a meeting next week that could determine the future of the world's third largest Christian denomination. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
On May 31st, dozens of guests filed into St. Bartholomew the Great, the London church immortalized in the movie Four Weddings and a Funeral. Giles Fraser, an Anglican vicar who was not there but knows the details, says it looked just like an elegant wedding.
They were all in their smart clothes and they had best men with them. They exchanged rings, they exchanged vows.
Vows that came almost word for word from the wedding service in the 1662 Book of Common Prayer.
In a sense, it was an incredibly traditional service, except for one thing, and that was that there were two men who were being joined, as it were.
Two Anglican priests, to be precise. Now, there are a good number of gay British clergy who have celebrated their unions, always quietly, because the Church of England discourages same-sex blessings. But this extravagant celebration in one of London's oldest churches, well, it was too much. The press went wild. The blessing was performed by Reverend Martin Dudley. In a BBC interview, he told how the ceremony came about. It all started, he said, with a visit from his friend and fellow vicar, Peter Crowell.
I remember we were setting up the Christmas crib as he turned up and said he had a question to ask me, and he asked me whether I would be prepared to bless him and David. Now, what do you say to a friend in a situation like that?
Well, presumably what you say as a minister in the Church of England with the House of Bishops' instruction in front of you is...
And it wasn't just the event that made the story so delicious. Dudley himself is no stranger to scandal. He was nicknamed Dud the Stud for sending romantic text messages to a female parishioner a few years back. And then there's the timing. The near wedding took place weeks before Anglican bishops from around the world arrive in England for its Lambeth Conference, a once every 10-year meeting when the bishops chart policy on issues like, well, gay clergy.
It is a bit ironic.
Henry Orombi is the Anglican Archbishop of Uganda, which claims 9.2 million members. Most African, Asian, and Latin American leaders were outraged when Gene Robinson, an openly gay man, was elevated to Bishop of New Hampshire 5 years ago. The Archbishop of Canterbury, titular head of the communion, tried to keep it from falling apart, pleading with the West to stop same-sex ceremonies. Orombi wonders how he can rein in the other churches when things like this happen under his own nose.
I think the truth has come out. The mother church, if I want to call it that way, is already in the same problem. Now, which way is the communion going? And we are asking ourselves and saying that is a reflection of how very far from biblical teaching and understanding has it where even the Church of England has gone.
Orombi says it's just one more reason why he's boycotting the Lambeth Conference, and not just he, but also the bishops of Nigeria, Kenya, and Rwanda, who together represent almost two-thirds of the practicing Anglicans in the world. Archbishop Greg Venables, who oversees most of South America, says the debate is not about homosexuality. It's about the role of the Bible. Conservatives say God's word is unchanging and above culture. Liberals say the Bible should be read with culture and the growing number of gay Anglicans in mind.
You've got original Christianity, as it's been believed over 2,000 years, and this new postmodern version, which has grown up in the West. So in terms of what we believe, you've already got two, I won't say two churches, because I'm not sure that's the word, but there is definitely a split.
And schism is on the minds of the nearly 300 conservative bishops who will gather in Jerusalem next week to chart their own Orthodox future. John Chain, the liberal bishop of Washington, D.C., is not worried.
To me, it's almost as if it was a death rattle. I think that the Anglican Communion, even with the internal disagreements that it has right now, really wants to move on, not to ignore the differences, but to really get on with living into what does it mean to be a missional church in the 21st century.
A few conservative bishops are going to Lambeth in a last-ditch effort to keep the communion together, but one says, I'm not holding my breath. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
The Barack Obama campaign is apologizing to two Muslim women for the way they were treated at a rally on Monday. Campaign volunteers told the women, who were wearing headscarves, that they couldn't sit behind the podium. It was apparently an effort to prevent them from appearing behind Obama in photos and on television. A friend of one of the women contacted Ben Smith, a reporter at Politico, and he writes about the story today. Ben, you have talked with one of the women. You've emailed with another. What's their version of what happened at this rally on Monday?
Well, in both cases, they were with groups of friends, some of them Muslim, some not, and volunteers approached their friends and said, would you come and sit in the special seating behind the candidate? And the friends said, we'd love to, but can our friend come along? And, she's wearing a headscarf. And that's where the volunteers both said, no, she can't. In one case, the friends of Heba Aref, who's a young lawyer in Detroit, were told that the political climate didn't permit Obama being, seen with somebody wearing a headscarf, somebody evidently visibly Muslim. In the other case, the woman's friends were told, and she was then later told, that they weren't allowing headgear on stage, no baseball caps and no headscarves, which isn't usually how headscarves are treated. They're usually treated like yarmulkes, like turbans, as sort of a religious exemption to that kind of rule.
And as we mentioned, Barack Obama's campaign has apologized, seems to be taking pains to say these were campaign volunteers. This is not the policy of the campaign itself.
Yeah, there's no evidence that it is the policy of the campaign generally. The next morning, he happened to be photographed standing beside a student at another Michigan university wearing a headscarf. But there is certainly a sensitivity to the issue of his being perceived as a Muslim, and that at some level, I think, trickled down to these volunteers, or a sensitivity to Islam being very controversial in America.
It's a tricky issue, Ben, because obviously Barack Obama has been trying to shoot down rumors that he is Muslim when, in fact, he's Christian. At the same time, doesn't want to alienate Muslims or imply that Islam is a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a really complicated thing because, yes, in some Muslims occasionally take offense at his saying, repeatedly, I'm not a Muslim because, what's wrong with that? And sometimes he'll say there's nothing wrong with that, but he doesn't always say it. And certainly the implication is that there's some political downside to being a Muslim in America right now.
Did that apology from the campaign satisfy the two women involved here?
I've only spoken to one of them about that, Heba Aref, who said that she wasn't quite satisfied because she thinks it's a big deal, basically, and that it really kind of cut against the core of Obama's message and his appeal to her. And she wanted a personal apology, and then she thought about it a little more and said that maybe just being asked to sit behind him at the next event would suffice.
It always is a question, I think, for those of us watching, who gets to pick who sits behind the candidate? And this all must be very carefully stage managed to get the perfect photo op.
Yeah, it's one of these unspoken, unwritten about things that the candidate, I don't think they circulate memos about it, but the candidate's advance staff very carefully select, the right demographic look as part of the staging of these theatrical events. Often it's about getting the right racial composition. When Obama, there was a question about his appeal to white women. Suddenly you'd see him at these events, with lots of middle-aged white women waving little American flags behind him. Hispanic guy in New Hampshire was telling me about a couple weeks ago being asked to contribute to the diversity behind John McCain at an event. So it's just like an advertising. It's something they think very hard about, although not something they like to talk about. And it's particularly for Obama, whose sort of message is about transcending the old-fashioned identity politics. It's something particularly kind of isn't quite consonant with his campaign.
Ben Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ben Smith, senior political reporter with Politico.